Well, as I said, we're going to begin a series of lessons dealing with evolution, and the reason for this is because there's a great deal of hype, assumptions, misinformation, and I hate to say this, but outright lies being spread by many in academia, the teachers, the professors, researchers, scientists of all kinds, concerning the subject of evolution. There are only two positions that one can take, feasibly, that is. We're just going to remove the alien thing out of the picture here, okay? Because I said feasibly. So there is the idea that we are created by a higher intelligence than ourselves, or there is the idea that we have evolved. And since the word created is assumed to be a religious position and a religious view, as opposed to a practical, intelligent, and rational one, many have chosen evolution because it sounds scientific and allegedly is based on science. Part of what I'm going to do in this series, I hope, is to show you that this evolution is neither historical or scientific. In fact, I'd like to start by just simply going into the definition of science here. And this is right out of Merriam-Webster's dictionary, and it's generally stated this way in any kind of source material, reference material here. It is a knowledge or a system of knowledge covering general truths or the operation of general laws, especially as obtained and tested through scientific method. And I underline some words here, words like truth, laws, and tested, because that's what is absolutely critical in order for whatever it is being done to be scientific here. And you're saying, well, what's a scientific method? Well, I'm glad you asked. That is defined as the principles and procedures for the systematic pursuit of knowledge involving the recognition and formulation of a problem, recognizing that there's a problem and stating it as thus, and the collection of data through, and again, some underlined words, observation and experiment and the formulation and testing of hypotheses. What I'm trying to do right up from the front is show you that the word science can be very misunderstood if it's taken out of context. Evolutionists are fond of saying that their research is all scientific and that evolution is all about science, and yet we're looking at the definitions of what science and scientific method actually are, and you're going to find that that does not support evolution. In fact, I'm going to go so far as to say what you've read on the screen here, that is what I believe. I believe in science. I certainly believe in the scientific method. But evolution as an ism, as a philosophy, really, does not conform to that science. It has never been observed. It has never been tested. It cannot be recreated. Evolution is touted as a science, but it actually fits another thing, which is not science at all, and that is called dogma. A dogma is defined as a point of view or tenet or belief put forth as authoritative without adequate grounds. What we're being fed today as science is actually dogma. And what's interesting about that is because that's the very term that usually gets stuffed down our throat when we try to defend the scripture or defend the existence of God. And people say, don't stuff your dogma down my throat, right? And so they stuff their dogma down our throat, and that's okay. And so what we're doing is we're simply responding to that here. We have a widely held opinion that is unsupported by the facts, that is masquerading as science. In contrast, the factual and historical evidence that we observe in the physical world actually supports the God of the Bible. And that is not an opinion, and that is not dogma, because there is adequate ground to support this. It is an intelligent conclusion based upon the facts. The theory of evolution is riddled with holes and contradictions, falsified information, propaganda, and certainly political bias. It is not based upon science or evidence or even respectable motives, but often is an open contempt for God, the Bible, and Christians and religion in general. I am not making this up. If you look into the history of where evolution came from in the 18th and 19th centuries, it is about a bunch of men, well-learned men, who wanted very much to find a solution, if you will, if that's the right word, for defining what the world is, its existence, our origin, without God and religion involved at all. And the reason they did it, is because many of these men were either atheists or agnostic or had just been burned on religion and therefore had a very sour taste about the whole situation. Simply put, though, evolution is not true, regardless of what is said or who says it. And the reason it's not true is because of what you see on the screen here. First of all, it violates everything we know to be true. And I'm going to show that as we go forward in our series here. Secondly, it cannot be verified factually or objectively, which is what is necessary if indeed it was science. And then thirdly, it contradicts what God has said is true and has proven to be true through whatever means is necessary to the extent that is necessary. I realize there's not a whole lot of, or I should say it this way, there's a lot of things we could ask God questions on that we don't have answers to, but what we need to know is sufficiently proven to us, what is necessary to know. So let me just start off by talking about the fundamental core of evolution itself. And the fundamental core is simply what it teaches. Every living thing evolved from a common single-celled organism or ancestor. And that immediately begs the question, well, where did that come from, right? And that came from, or evolved from, an inanimate, non-living material, raw elements, if you will. And of course, that begs the question, well, where did that come from? And that's where there is really no explanation. Many cling still to the Big Bang theory, which says that all matter in the entire universe was somehow compacted to a basketball-sized ball and then inexplicably exploded, and then inexplicably, nanoseconds after the explosion, started creating what we know as constellations, galaxies, and so on. And that actually creates more profound questions than it actually solves. Despite the claims, no one has ever proved the Big Bang has occurred. And that's interesting because someone just recently, several years ago, won a Nobel Prize. I think two men won a Nobel Prize for proving that the Big Bang occurred. If you look at the details of what they actually prove that the Big Bang could have occurred if you buy into their premise about what is happening in the first place. And that's a lot of what's being sold to us in the public domain today, is that there's this unstated premise that you have to kind of buy into evolution in order for evolution to work. By the way, that's called circular reasoning, where you're trying to prove the thing being proved by using the thing itself in the proof. Okay, that's circular reasoning. It doesn't work, and it doesn't work for us any more than it works for the evolutionists here when we use circular reasoning in religion. The Big Bang involves laws and processes which no one has ever seen, which defies everything that we have seen, and is completely lacking for any factual evidence. It violates all known laws of physics and thermodynamics, and yet is touted to be a scientific explanation. So basically what we have then is an explanation that goes against everything we know to be true. It goes against everything we've seen to be true. It goes against every law we know to exist in physics and thermodynamics. And yet it is the explanation, the best explanation that men have come up with in determining how we came to be. And all this happened without a plan, without a blueprint, without a purpose, without a stated goal, without intelligent oversight. It was a series of unfortunate accidents that happened over eons of time. Someone has likened it to a giant tornado going through a huge junkyard, and as a result of that chaos, a brand new, fully functional, fully automated 747 jumbo jet appears over eons of time. And that sort of thing just doesn't happen. And we know it doesn't happen. And yet that is exactly what we're being told has happened. And not only that, but no one dares to dissent from what happened. C.S. Lewis has made a good argument in his book, God in the Dock. He says, if we are all accidents of material nature, then whatever conscious conclusions we come up with are also accidental, including claims of materialists, evolutionists, and atheists. So why should we believe that these people are true or right? They are part of the accident. What is true if everything is predicated upon inexplicable accidents, after all? Why should one accidental explanation be held as superior to another? Let me just put it this way, even though it sounds offensive to say it this way, but let's just use that logic. If the Bible is an accident, and evolution is an accident, why is one thing right and the other one is wrong? See, the process and the logic here, the train of logic put forward is fundamentally flawed, is really what he's getting at, and that's what I'm getting at as well. Okay? We're just arbitrarily choosing to believe in evolution as a society simply because it's not religion. And it's not science either, but we're painting it as science, in other words, to make it work and to make it legitimate and respectable. So here we get into more of some of the background, and I'm going to go deviate from some of the notes that you have. I'm actually condensing this lesson down from what you have, so it'll be shorter than what you think. So let's talk about the philosophic core of evolution. Secular scientists and atheists want a purely mechanical or material explanation for who we are and how we came to be without any reference to or dependence upon a supernatural being or any kind of miraculous intervention, anything that supersedes the natural world. Can't have that, okay? Why can't we have that? Well, because that's religion, and we're all about science. We need to only have science as an explanation for who we are and how we all came to be. So what are we going to depend upon? We're going to depend upon something called nature. And this nature then becomes a god unto itself. It becomes a deified entity in essence. This nature makes decisions, gives direction, weeds out inferior things, capitalizes on advantageous adaptations here, and so on. In other words, what scientists have done, whether they realize it or not, is they've ascribed very godlike qualities to this non-god entity called nature. But in the process, they have also recognized that this nature is impersonal, has no personality. It is amoral, which means there is no moral system ascribed to it whatsoever. It remains undefined. It's just nature, nothing else. It is a mythical entity. And this is highly convenient, of course, but it's hardly scientific. It's kind of like a merging of mythology and the appearance of science altogether. And whenever we do that, what do we come up with? Fiction, okay? Fiction like Lord of the Rings type stuff and that sort of thing, Hobbitvilles and all that, right? Are there Hobbitvilles? Anyway, you know what I'm talking about, okay? That sort of thing is just fiction. It's just stuff we're making up. It's stuff that we create with our own imagination and we stamp it as science, and therefore it is scientific. And the reason why they want this is not because evolution makes sense or can be proven or even because it's scientific, but simply because it removes God from the picture. I've read a number of books by evolutionists, atheists, agnostics, who are all very highly critical of God and the Bible and Christians in particular. And one thing that resounds, one thing that comes out of all of these books is they want to do what they want to do, and they do not want to have to answer to any kind of religious authority of any sort. If they want to have sex, they want to have sex. If they want to get drunk, they want to get drunk. If they want to go out and divorce their wife and marry someone else or commit adultery or whatever they want to do, they just want to be able to do that without having to feel morally responsible for their actions. And that is a lot of what drives this sort of philosophy or this mentality. If you have no Bible, then you have no God. You have no sin, you have no Savior. You have no moral responsibility to a higher authority other than man himself. You have no moral accountability. That means that there is no afterlife. That means that there is no heaven, there is no hell, there is no reward, there is no consequence because you have no soul. By the way, the idea that you have no soul is absolutely necessary if indeed we did evolve, because evolution can't create souls. All it does is mess with physical things that are already in existence. That's all that it can explain, if it could even explain that. So to accomplish this, there has to be the suppression of dialogue and dissent. There has to be a refusal to allow the other side to present counter evidence and counter arguments, or even a different explanation than evolution. And that smacks of something to hide. And we are seeing this in our public schools, we are seeing this in the universities, we are seeing this at every level of academia, where evolution is being taught as fact. There is no room for dialogue or dissension. It is being taught as fact. You either like it or you leave. You don't have room to offer a counter proposal, however intelligent or rational that proposal might be. And sadly, scientists, and scientists usually are thought to be a allegedly respectable profession, and I think there are respectable scientists out there, but there are some scientists that are so desperate that they are willing to cheat, they're willing to lie, they are willing to cover up any evidence that refutes their audacious claims. They are willing to create entire prehistoric eras from scraps of bone and fossils and teeth. They are willing to put feathers on a fossil if that's what they need to sell it to the public. There was a prehistoric animal put on the cover of, I think it was Time magazine several years ago. It had nothing to do with being a bird, but they wanted it to be kind of a missing link between birds and dinosaurs, so they put feathers on it. There's no feathers in the actual fossil record regarding this particular creature, but they put feathers on it because they needed to sell it that way. And so that's what they're going to do. If they need feet to appear on fish and so that the feet, or fish rather, can walk on dry land and survive somehow, well, then they'll add feet to it. If they find human footprints overlapping dinosaur prints, then they're going to deny one or the other or both. If Christians dare question them, and this is important, if Christians dare question them or challenge the evolutionary conclusions, they attack God and the concept of faith rather than offering a scientific explanation. In other words, they go for the ad hominem attack. They attack the person and what that person believes in rather than saying, well, here's the proof, here's the evidence that supports what we're saying. Again, I want to be clear. I'm not saying all scientists do this. What I'm saying is it is done, and it's done more often than you and I are told. And a lot of the evidence that we get at the final end in the public domain, in the public mind, has already been sifted and colored and decorated in such a way so that we'll buy it as an evolutionary explanation. But we don't get to see the raw evidence for ourselves. Now let me back up here and say that the world, the universe, if you look at it at first glance, it is largely mechanical. It is largely material. There's no argument with that. And it does operate on fixed laws. It does have the appearance at first glance that there is no supernatural being involved. We don't see God. He has not explained everything that he has done. But that doesn't explain everything that's going on. While it largely appears mechanical, it's never entirely mechanical. Anytime that we see some of these things here that you see on the screen, things that a mechanical, materialistic world cannot produce by itself, anytime we see evidence of design, purpose, complexity, or order, those are things that a purely mechanical, material world cannot produce on their own. It's just impossible for a mechanical world. And by mechanical, I simply mean just raw things working together without any direction, without any intervention of any kind. It's impossible for interdependent systems to come into being separately but simultaneously. And one of the best examples of that is the human reproductive system, for example. I don't mean to get all technical here, but okay. There's male parts and there's female parts, and these things have to work together in order to produce a child. And if those things did not evolve separately but simultaneously, then there's no way that those two people, male and female, can produce a child. It is impossible. So what had to happen is a female had to develop as a female with all the reproductive parts necessary for producing a child, and the man had to also at the same time evolve and develop at the same time, at the same rate. And meanwhile, while all of this is happening, remember this takes millions of years, that's what we're always being told. So over this millions of years, babies are being born through this non-mature system of reproduction. If you're scratching your head and going, how did that happen? That is my point exactly. How did that happen? And by the way, we should mention here that whenever the only thing that two adult humans can produce is a human child. They can't produce anything more or less than a human child. And if that is true, and just think about that, if that single point is true, that the only thing that two humans can produce is a human child, Then how in the world can we explain evolution? Because all they're ever going to produce is a human child. And they could never have produced anything less than a human child. And if they were anything less than human themselves, then they couldn't have produced a human child that who also could produce other humans eventually. This gets mind-bogglingly absurd in a hurry. And that's one of the things I'm trying to show you, is that it all sounds good on paper. It all looks good in the textbook. It all sounds good when you got some high-ranked professor up there behind a lectern lecturing to a bunch of college kids. It all sounds like it makes sense then. But when you start breaking it down and looking at it and going, what? It doesn't sound very scientific anymore, does it? And so we have some problems with that. In a purely mechanical world, there's no explanation for human consciousness, including the human soul, by the way, or rational thought. Where did that come from? Evolution cannot explain. It has no explanation for it. It cannot explain man's need to worship something more intelligent than himself, unless, of course, there was proof that there is something more intelligent than man himself. Why would we choose to believe that unless there was evidence for it? So just think about all these different things here. This is very similar to the human body itself. On the surface, your body appears to be entirely mechanical, biological, physical. And largely, that is true. If you think about yourself as far as what you observe anyway about yourself, well, you are mostly those things. And yet human life and human reasoning are non-mechanical, non-biological, and non-physical, and that comprises what we call the spiritual element of any given person. And not surprisingly, when that spiritual element leaves that human body, then we have a dead body. We have a corpse. So it's absolutely critical that that non-tangible, non-physical part of us be associated with this physical body in order for us to be alive and human. I want you to read with me Romans chapter 1. I know a lot of times these lessons use this passage, first of all, because it's an awesome passage that really gets to the point in a hurry. But I want to not focus on the moral aspect of it that he starts off with in verse 18, but I want to go right to verse 19 here. He says, that which is known about God is evident within them. He's talking, the them here are the ancients, non-Jewish people that have existed for history, all of history now. He says, God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power, his divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what? Through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. And that is powerful. In other words, before we go into the Bible and start looking at Bible evidences and Bible scriptures and Bible quotations and citations, the evidence that Paul offers here is not through scripture or miracles or testimonies of Jesus Christ himself, but rather he looks at the human body and an intelligent and organized world, an intelligently organized world. And he says that alone ought to show us that we are not an evolved people, we are a created people. It doesn't say a lot about, factually anyway, about God's personality as yet, but it does tell us most certainly that there has to be a God. That's really what he's getting at. And it continues to make rational sense. Regardless of whatever thing, anything else that we know about God, the world provides prolific and amazing evidence of intelligent design. There can be no logical explanation except that God exists. This is not a religious belief. This is an intelligent, rational, and yes, necessary belief given the evidence, which, by the way, is definitely greater than any evidence that is offered for evolution. So anytime that someone is saying, oh, you believe in God, well, and God created the world, and that's your religious belief, say, religious belief? That's my scientific belief at work here, because there's evidence and reasoning and observable testimony, all the things we need for it to be scientifically proven, in essence. We can see all that this stuff has to have a creator. And not only that, but God himself created science. That's why I believe in science, because God created it, and it defends him. It doesn't go against him at all. It defends him. So the Bible simply gives definition to what we already know intelligently and even intuitively. I'm not going to go through and read all these verses here, but we have a number of verses starting in Genesis 1:1. God created the heavens and the earth. Isaiah 37:16 talks about how God alone knows, has created the heaven and earth. I just want to show you that the Bible does speak often and consistently about God being the creator. God created the heavens and stretched them out, spread out the earth and its offspring. God created the heavens. He is the one who formed the earth and made it, established it, did not create it a waste place, but formed it to be inhabited. That's what God says about himself. These are all scriptures that are in your notes here, by the way. For from him and through him and to him are all things, Paul says in Romans 11:36. In 1 Corinthians 8, verse 5 and 6, even if there are other so-called gods, and there are as far as idols and mythological gods and so on, there is but one God from whom are all things and we exist for him, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, by whom are all things and we exist through him. And then Colossians, I'm not going to read this because it was read for us already. Bob read it for us before, Colossians chapter 1, specifically verse 15 through 17, where it talks about how Christ has made all things and by his power all things are held together. Now keep in mind, these aren't just statements out of the Bible here. These aren't just religious statements. These are statements that are consistent with the Creator having created the world, that we know intelligently by looking at the world that we live in and say, this could not have just happened. So what these passages are doing is just confirming for us what we know intuitively and intelligently to be true. God has appointed God has appointed Christ, the heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. And worthy are you, O Lord, our God, to receive glory and honor and power, for you have created all things. Because of your will, they existed and were created. Revelation 4:11. That isn't an exhaustive list whatsoever, but nothing in the geological formations of the physical earth, the fossil record, or even known human history contradicts God as creator. Quite the opposite. These things, when examined objectively without trying to fit some agenda, when they're examined scientifically, objectively, critically even, then they lead to that conclusion. As I said, evolution does not explain the true origin of man, but simply rearranges existing materials. Doesn't tell you where the materials came from, doesn't tell you how they got arranged, doesn't tell you who decided how they should be arranged. It just simply says, well, there's this thing called evolution, and this happened. And you're looking at that going, that's not an explanation. That's called fiction, once again. Evolution attempts to explain man's physical existence and fails at that, I truly believe, but has zero explanation for man's non-physical or spiritual existence. Evolution says that all life on Earth, including the Earth itself, is the result of trillions of so-called beneficial accidents, mutations, alterations that occurred imperceptibly slowly over eons of time. Again, no plan, no purpose, no design, no intelligence involved, no one in charge but blind forces of nature. Which means that human beings have no purpose, we have no meaning, we have no soul, we have no future, we have no hope. There's no reason to live lovingly or responsibly. If we are accidents, then so is love and responsibility. Those are accidents too. Why should we believe them? Why should we practice them? The Bible, in contrast, portrays God as the creator, a benevolent creator. Human beings are the highest form of earthly creation. We have a moral responsibility to our creator. We will be held accountable to him. We have a purpose for life. We are created on purpose. We are created with purpose, and we are created by a purpose-driven God. Given the premise of an all-powerful, all-knowing creator, creation makes sense. Evolutionists often say, well, you've got to choose between creation and science. You can't have them both. That is baloney. That's called a false dilemma. In logic circles, it's basically an attempt to confound your opponent, okay? But the fact is, it's a false dilemma, the false part of it being the dilemma being posed in itself, that you have to choose. You don't have to choose. I believe in science, and I believe in God. I do not have to choose between the two because science vindicates God and God created science. Science is so complex and so important, it takes a God of that magnitude to have created it in the first place, if you think about it in that respect. Someone says, well, yeah, but you got to believe that God exists. Well, that can be done to the extent that is necessary through the physical material evidence, through the physical laws, through necessary inference, written histories, historical fulfillment of prophecies written hundreds and thousands of years apart, eyewitness testimonies, and not to mention the proven claims of Jesus Christ himself that were supported by visible, proven miracles. This is all evidence that the evolutionist does not have whatsoever. He doesn't have any of that evidence or any of that kind of evidence, not evidence of that magnitude whatsoever. I'm going to just kind of go through here this last part and simply say evolution is a dogma, not a science. It's a widely held opinion that has inadequate means to support it. And the Bible has been proven to be true and accurate by all who objectively examine it. Rather, it has stood the test of time. It has stood millions of critics, many of who have become believers in trying to disprove it. Its teachings and conclusions directly affect every single person who has ever lived. You cannot ignore or reject the Bible without serious consequences. On the other hand, the theory of evolution would disappear if everyone would just quit talking about it. It would just evaporate. And there's zero consequences for not following through in believing it. There's zero consequences, if you think about it. I want to leave you with one last thought here, because I think this is pretty powerful, what Paul says in Acts 17, verse 30 and 31, and the first part of verse 32. Having overlooked the times of ignorance, God is now declaring to men that all people everywhere should repent, because he has fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom he has appointed, having furnished proof, not just by having said, but having furnished proof to all men by raising him from the dead. Now when they, some of the Athenians that he's talking to, heard of the resurrection of the dead, some began to sneer. And I believe that many people are still doing this today. They are sneering with contempt at God, at his word, at Jesus Christ, at the resurrection, but that doesn't change for a moment what is coming. Everything Paul said is still coming. That is in our future. That is in your future. You don't have to believe in it, but that doesn't change what's coming. If you want to believe in evolution, you are free to do so. God will let you do so, but that doesn't change your responsibility to him, and you will be held accountable to him. That's not a threat. It's not meant to be scary. That's the truth. That's just what you need to know. That's part of your moral responsibility as a created being, as opposed to being a sheer accident in the universe. So think about what we've said so far. Next week, what I want to get into is talking about some of the lies, specifically some of the lies that evolution teaches that are purported to make that a scientific theory. Okay? Enough said for tonight. Appreciate you all hearing me out on this. Hopefully this has been a bit educational, maybe even inspirational. If there's anyone that needs to respond to our lesson tonight, if you need to come forward, this would be your time to do so as we stand and sing.